Chapter 19. Frank Cooper huddled deep in the Malinta tunnel system in the bowels of Corregidor Island and tried not to spill the soupy gruel as his spoon traversed from the bowl to his mouth. He tried to time each bite between the explosions slamming Lindley Field to the east. Every day since General King had surrendered the Bataan Peninsula back in early April, the daily bombardments of Corregidor had increased in severity. Betting pools on how many shells the Japanese would hurl at them that day sprang up, but it soon became impossible to count them all. Paper currency meant almost nothing on the island. The betting commodity consisted mainly of cigarettes, rations, and water. The gruel had chunks of meat floating around the top, and he thought about the mules and horses that artillery fire had shredded the day before. He'd seen the aftermath and wondered how they'd been able to salvage any of the meat at all. By now, he was used to being hungry. He figured he'd probably lost 15 to 20 pounds since December 8. He wasn't in as bad a shape as some of the other guys, but he always felt weak and sickly. He could still pull a trigger, though, and he planned to fight to the bitter end when the time came. He finished the gruel by licking his spoon, then the bottom of the bowl. He took a sip of water. He forced himself not to gulp it down or spill a single drop. Food and water had become more precious than gold. He excused himself from the other men and went looking for Captain Yates. Yates had been spending a lot of time in the communications section lately. He'd let it slip that a submarine was coming in that night to evacuate 25 people off the island. Yates was on the list. He tried to convince Frank to join him, stating he could make a case for him since he was his assistant and essential to his job. But Frank had seen the others on the list. He couldn't see himself saving his own skin by bumping a nurse off the list. No way in hell he wanted any part of that. Yates understood and didn't ask about it again. Frank found Yates talking with a colonel. Frank didn't want to interrupt, so he pulled back. But Yates saw him and motioned him into the small room he'd been using as his. Frank snapped to attention and saluted. Yates said, "Corporal Cooper, this is Colonel Winters." Winters said,
"At ease, Corporal."
Frank noticed four large bags marked as mail. He had given the quartermaster five letters when he'd come around asking for mail. He'd written a few of them while still on Bataan, and a few more on Corregidor. This was the first opportunity they had given him to get a letter to his family back home since the Japanese attacked. "Good to meet you, sir." Frank pointed at the bags of mail. "I sure hope those bags get through. It's been a long time since I've been able to send a letter." Colonel Winters said,
"Yeah, me too. If they don't, neither will me or Captain Yates."
Captain Yates said, "Colonel Winters has a full list of personnel staying on the island. You're honored, of course." Frank nodded, but felt apprehension creeping in. The only reason to do something like that was if they didn't expect them to report in themselves. A list of those left behind. Yates said, "I know it sounds macabre, but..." He shrugged. "It's necessary," Frank finished for him. "A list of the doomed." Both Yates and Winters looked up at him. Frank stared back. He didn't feel bitter. He just fully understood the situation. He didn't feel the need to put up a facade of hope when there wasn't any. Colonel Winters pursed his lips and said,
"It's been rough, and it's going to get worse. Wainwright's an outstanding commander. He's got the 4th Marine Regiment, Filipino, Navy, and Army personnel to draw upon. He's still got plenty of artillery to hurl at them and enough AA to keep the planes at bay. We've already hurt those bastards bad. We've stalled their progress far longer than anyone back in Washington thought possible. But you're right. Food and water are running out. We get weaker every day, and they just keep getting stronger. It's a simple equation. It's only a matter of time.
When they come, we'll make them pay for every yard, sir," Frank said. Yates stood and extended his hand. He and Frank shook, not as an officer and an NCO, but as friends. Yates said, "I'll make sure those letters get to your parents. I've got their address, so if the bags get lost, I will write them personally." He gripped Frank's shoulder. "You're a good man, Frank."
When this is all over, drinks will be on me. Frank took a step back and saluted. Yates stiffened and returned it. I'll take you up on that, Captain. He nodded to the colonel and left them to pack and prepare for the incoming submarine. Down the corridor 100 yards, he stopped to light a precious cigarette. The Japanese artillery had stopped for the moment. He leaned against the tunnel wall and savored the taste of the cigarette. He thought about meeting Yates after the war, but he couldn't see how that would ever be possible. Assuming the war would end, they'd both have to survive it, and the odds of that seemed minuscule at best. Private Sean Cooper seethed at his continued harsh treatment. The men who'd picked him and Ilsa up from the restaurant had left him in the dark basement for many hours. He'd held his urine as long as he could, but couldn't keep from relieving himself while still tied to the chair. Soon after debasing himself, the lights came on and the door opened. Without a word, they had whisked him away, this time without a bag over his head, but they kept his hands bound behind his back. After ascending 3 flights of stairs, his captors thrust him into a room with a desk and 2 chairs. They forced him to sit. Both men's noses crinkled at the smell of urine mixed with sweat and fear. Sean scowled at them now, wanting to bash their smug heads against the edge of the desk. He felt like a cornered wild animal, piss and all. The 2 men stepped back. The door behind the desk opened, and the man who'd interrogated Sean earlier entered from a bathroom, wiping his hands on a towel. He saw Sean sitting there, and he smiled as though seeing a long-lost friend.
PFC Sean Cooper. So nice of you to drop by. We haven't been formally introduced. You can call me Mr. Portman.
He sat down and leaned back in his chair. Sean stifled the urge to lash out. He pictured himself jumping over his bound hands so he could use the rope to strangle him. But instead, he stared and worked on controlling his rage.
Still not too talkative, I see.
He waved his hand dismissively.
Well, no matter. It seems your commanding officer wants a word with you. He's none too happy, I'm afraid.
Stunned, Sean finally asked,
You're releasing me?
For the time being, yes.
What about all that spy bullshit from before? Where's Ilsa?
It isn't bullshit, Cooper. Miss Engel is a German national. She lied to you. She's been lying to you the whole time. I'm afraid old Shakespeare's idiom still holds true. Love is blind.
Cooper muttered under his breath.
Chaucer, idiot.
What was that? Can I see her?
No. Miss Engel is not your concern any longer.
Sean felt a pit in his stomach. He wanted to scream, to lash out, to cry, to kill, but he swallowed his emotions, not wanting to show any weakness to this asshole.
He got control of himself and said, I need to get cleaned up. I can't see Lieutenant Hennessy covered in my own piss.
Mr. Portman scowled, stood, and glanced at Sean's crotch. For the first time, Sean heard sympathy in Portman's voice.
Oh, hell. I didn't know. You can use my shower.
He motioned to the bathroom behind him.
I'll have a fresh uniform brought over for you. And by the way, it's not Lieutenant Hennessy, but Captain Johnson you'll be seeing.
Nothing could surprise Sean any more today.
He'd stand in front of the company commander?
Okay.
I guess that makes some sense, he thought. Is this my last day as a paratrooper?
He stood, and Portman motioned to the 2 men behind him. They untied his hands, and Sean rubbed the soreness from his wrists. He walked past Portman, not taking his eyes off him.
Would he get in trouble if he attacked him? Strangled the life out of him?
He wasn't military. At least he didn't wear a uniform or have any insignia. For all he knew, these clowns could be the enemy. He walked into the bathroom, stripped off his sodden uniform, turned on the shower, stepped inside, and quietly wept beneath the lukewarm water. Carlos got word soon after they'd taken Ilsa. His contacts ran deep, particularly among the restaurant and bar owners. At least it wasn't the damn Nazis. His sources had tailed the vehicle all the way to the U.S. Army base. He pondered the description of the men who'd taken her and her hapless lover. Did the U.S. have plainclothes soldiers out and about? Perhaps they weren't soldiers at all.
Who are they? He wondered. A new player.
The playing field was already way too crowded for his liking. How should he proceed? That was an easier question to answer. He needed to watch the Americans, find where they held Ilsa, and somehow get her out of there before the shipment arrived. He wondered how Ilsa had missed seeing the men. Normally, she didn't miss a thing. 3 times she'd evaded Nazi spies. He'd seen her take violent action twice since meeting her, and both times she'd outfought men twice her size with relative ease. Someone had obviously trained her in close combat, but when he had asked about it, she demurred and changed the subject quickly. How had these Americans gotten the upper hand on her? He had a feeling it had something to do with that damnable paratrooper. He cursed her. He'd warned her against getting involved with the American, but she'd ignored him, and now they held her. What would she tell them? Would she give up the operation? He needed her. Without her, the whole thing would fall apart. She was the contact, the only one they'd deal with, the only one they'd pay. Of course she'd give up the operation. The question was, what would the Americans do about it? Ilsa Engel listened to the American across the bare table from her ask one more time,
So, you're saying you're not a German spy? That you are working against them, in fact?
Like I've told you countless times, yes. She knew how interrogations worked. Back in Germany, she'd been through far more intense training scenarios than this one. Time and repetition were the things they used against you, waiting for the slight change in the story or the slightest hesitation. Any chink in the armor, anything to pry open and expose. But she didn't have time for any of this. The shipment would come in just 2 days. She had to get out of here, and the only way she could do that was by convincing these men to trust her. Just a little. She stared into his eyes. He told her his name, but she doubted it was his real name. She tried a new tack.
Mr. Blake, I know how this works. I'm not denying that I'm German. I'm not even denying that the Germans have trained me in espionage. You have no reason to trust that I don't still work for them. But I'm telling you, I don't. Quite the opposite, in fact.
She leaned forward and continued.
I can prove it to you.
Intrigued, Mr. Blake glanced at his cohort in the corner, then refocused on her.
I'm listening.
I'm going to tell you something I'm not proud of. Something I did to defend myself and my mission.
She looked at her bound hands, then back into Mr. Blake's eyes. She said,
A couple of weeks ago, 2 Nazi henchmen tried to apprehend me. They've been searching for me for over a year now, and they finally found me. I had no choice but to defend myself.
She hesitated, and Blake prompted her somewhat skeptically.
Go on. I can tell you where to find the bodies, or I can take you there myself.
You killed 2 Nazis here in the Panama Zone?
Yes.
Assuming that's true, big assumption, how will we know they're who you say they are?
Who else would they be? I threw their papers in the hole with them. I'm sure they're forged, but I'm confident you'll find other hints of their nationality and who they work for once we dig them up.
Carlos got the word that Ilsa had been spotted being put into a car only moments after it occurred. He couldn't believe his luck. If he'd been outside, he wouldn't have heard the incoming phone call, and he wouldn't have been able to activate his small army of informers to keep tabs on the vehicle. He made a mental note of the caller, Maria Estevez. He remembered she worked at the U.S. Army base laundry. He needed to give her a nice bonus. He grabbed his handheld walkie-talkie, pulled a filthy cover off an ancient, banged-up motorcycle, and sat on it. He rarely used it. Gas and oil were both difficult to come by and expensive, not to mention the challenge of finding parts if something went wrong. To anyone walking past, it looked like just another piece of scrap metal rusting into the ground. But he kept the engine tuned and ready for times like these. He listened to the updates as Ilsa and her American captors ambled their way through the crowded streets. He started the little motorcycle, and it putted to life after 1 try. He patted the handlebars and muttered, Good, loyal girl. He put it into gear and pulled away from the ditch, running with filthy water. Soon he'd maneuvered himself along a parallel road. He couldn't see them, but knew from the updates that they were one block away, still moving north. He scowled. Soon that road would leave the congestion of city traffic, and his updates would stop as the car would outdistance his people on bicycles trying to keep tabs on them. Time to move over and get on the same road. But before he did, it dawned on him. He slammed his hand on the handlebars and picked up the walkie-talkie.
"Break off," he said in Spanish. "I know where they're going."
Instead of veering onto their road, he accelerated. Traffic on this road was much lighter than the main road, and what little there was he could easily avoid.
"She's a clever one," he said, and he rubbed the speedometer lovingly.
Soon he topped out his speed and his road merged with the main road. He chanced a glance behind, but didn't see them yet. He didn't doubt their destination for an instant, though. It made perfect sense. The Americans would need proof that she wasn't a Nazi spy, and showing them a couple of dead Nazis she'd killed would be just the thing. He didn't know what they'd do with her then, but he'd be close by if she needed him. He could feel the weight of the .38 caliber pistol he had shoved into his waistband. He hoped he wouldn't need to use it, but he wouldn't hesitate.
"Pull in here,"
Ilsa pointed to a wide point in the road. The driver veered in and stopped in front of a seemingly impregnable wall of green jungle. Portman, in the front passenger seat, asked,
"Here?"
Ilsa nodded. Mr. Portman held an M1 carbine. He stepped out and ordered,
"Keep her there while I check it out."
Ilsa, Mr. Blake, and the driver watched him walk around, searching for an ambush. He finally waved for them to join him. Ilsa waited for the driver to open her door. Annoyingly, they'd kept her hands bound behind her back. She scooted to the edge and stood. She breathed in the powerful scent of the jungle. She loved it out here. Raw jungle. Blake and the driver each grabbed an arm, and she lifted her chin to the right.
"Over there. There's a cut in the jungle. There's a trail."
They led her the few yards and stopped when they couldn't go any further.
"Behind those vines. Push through it."
Mr. Portman held the carbine at port arms. He took a step and was about to do just that when Ilsa blurted,
"Check for snakes first."
Portman stopped and cringed. He looked back at her and she smiled.
"Sometimes they like to mimic the vines. Just give them a whack or two."
Portman looked none too happy. He studied the vines, then swung the carbine and hit them a few times. He looked back at her and she said,
"That should do it."
He shook his head and pushed into the vines. He disappeared a moment later, and Blake and the driver tensed and exchanged a quick glance. Portman poked his head back through.
"It's fine. There's a trail, just like she said. Lou, get the shovels from the trunk."
The driver broke off, and Blake held her arm, and they pushed her through. Without her hands to protect her, she felt the vines sliding across her face. When they reached the other side, it opened up. Bits of daylight streamed from above and through the vines, but the temperature dropped noticeably. An animal trail snaked away through the lush green jungle floor. The driver pushed through a few seconds later, holding two shovels. He admired the scenery.
"Wow, this is amazing."
Portman scolded him.
"Can it, Lou? Keep your eyes peeled."
Ilsa said,
"This would be a lot easier if you untied my hands. You're armed. I'm not. I've cooperated fully."
Portman shook his head.
"No."
She sighed and pointed as best she could with her shoulder.
"Follow the trail. They're buried about 30 meters up. They'll be on the left unless the animals dug them up."
Portman gave her a harsh look.
She shrugged and said, "They're buried deep, but you never know out here. That reminds me. Watch for predators. You're not the top of the food chain out here."
"Just take us to the bodies," Portman said. She knew the approximate location of where she and Carlos had buried the bodies, but the jungle had already covered any sign of their digging. She said,
"This is it. Right about here, I think," she said, poking the ground with her foot. "About 5 feet down."
Blake and Lou looked at Portman. Portman sat on a moss-covered rock and propped the carbine on his leg.
I'll watch her while you two dig.
Blake said, should have brought some army guys out with us. They love to dig.
It took a few different spots until Lou's shovel finally sliced into something besides dirt. He reeled and fell backward, holding his nose and struggling to get away.
Oh, God! Oh, God!
The stench overtook them like a tidal wave. It increased in intensity, and both Lou and Blake vomited at the same instant. Portman gagged but kept his lunch down. He covered his nose with the front of his shirt. Ilsa couldn't cover her nose. She cringed, but she'd smelled rotting flesh before and she'd expected it. She doubted she'd ever get used to it, no matter how many times she smelled it, though. While they were distracted, she had a moment to look for Carlos. She knew he lay somewhere nearby. His informants would have warned him of her departure, and she knew he'd suspect their destination by the route she'd taken them on. She'd seen his single motorcycle track a few kilometers back, but she'd seen no other signs of him since. I'll bet he's angry with me, she thought. The men got control of themselves, secured cloths over their noses, and continued to unearth the two bodies. Lou and Blake cursed and gasped, but finally pulled them from their holes and laid them side by side. The worms had been busy, the corpse's eyes long gone, but both bodies still looked human and relatively intact. They found the papers she'd mentioned and gave them to Portman to look over. Then they went through their pockets and found bits and pieces of their lives. One had a photograph of an older couple that must have been the deceased's parents. The picture could have been from any country, but the back had a faded scrawled note written in German. So proud of you, Willy. Heil Hitler. Blake found a lighter. He rubbed the dirt off and said, Nazi swastika on it. He flicked it, and on the third try, a flame sparked to life. It still works. He tossed it to Portman, who caught it and examined it carefully. He said, Why would a spy carry memorabilia that could incriminate him? Ilsa sighed and said, Arrogance. I saw it all the time. It's against the rules, of course, but everyone carried something. Portman pocketed the lighter and stood. We'll have these bodies taken back to base for a more thorough look. You still don't believe me? She asked incredulously. Portman shrugged. Pretty convenient. A little too easy. Ilsa sputtered. You think I planted these? Somehow knowing I'd be picked up by Americans weeks after I killed them? Who the hell do you think they are? Portman sat back down, obviously enjoying himself. His smug smile grated on Ilsa. She smiled and raised her voice. You know, one word from me, and you're a dead man. All the men stopped what they were doing and stared at her. Portman stood again and looked around the jungle nervously. But I won't do that. I want you to trust me because I'm telling the truth. What are you talking about? Portman said angrily. He leveled the carbine at her. Don't try anything. I'm not one of your little paratrooper playboy buddies. She raised her voice louder. Carlos! Show yourself! From behind the rock, Carlos appeared. He had his pistol leveled at the back of Portman's head. At first, Portman didn't see him, but Lou and Blake did. Seeing their stunned expressions, Portman turned slowly into the barrel only feet away, pointed straight at his face. He blanched and tried to speak, but Ilsa said, I'm sparing your life so you'll trust me. She stepped forward and stood in front of Portman. Carlos, put the weapon down. Carlos swore in Spanish but did as ordered. He complained, You never let me have any fun. Portman finished making his case in front of Captain Johnson. That's what we'll need from you, Captain. We'll run the show on the ground. You guys back us up if things go south. Captain Johnson still didn't know who this guy was exactly. He'd been surprised as everyone else when he'd learned of the shadowy group's existence within the confines of his own base. They used their own side entrance and kept an extremely low profile. Johnson didn't pretend to know every nook and cranny of the sprawling base, but it still galled him. And Colonel Kinsler knows about this. Portman equivocated. He knows about us, of course, but there's no time to fill him in on the rest. He's off inspecting troops somewhere at the moment. There's no time. The ship comes in this evening.
And you still don't know what the shipment is.
She won't tell us, just says it's not dangerous. It's not weapons or anything like that.
And you trust her?
Portman looked at the floor and pinched his lower lip with his fingers. He finally said, "Enough to give her a chance? Yes. Look, if we had more time, I'd wring it out of her, but we don't. The ship will dock in just a few hours. I confirmed that myself."
"Are you expecting trouble? I don't like going into something with such little information."
"She says this will be her fourth shipment. She had trouble once before, but she took care of that a few days before the shipment. She's never had an issue with the handoff and doesn't expect one now."
"The bodies you found?"
"Yes, them. When this is all done, and we know exactly what we're dealing with here, we'll dive deep. I have a feeling this woman is the real deal, though."
"But we don't know who she works for."
"Right. She says she works for herself. We'll get to the bottom of that later."
Johnson still didn't like it, but he agreed to it. "Okay. I'll send a squad of my paratroopers out there with you."
"Not MPs?"
"If things go badly, you'll want paratroopers. Believe me."
Portman nodded but continued standing in front of him, obviously struggling with something.
"Is there something else, Mr. Portman?"
"Yes, sir. Miss Engel wants PFC Cooper to be there."
Captain Johnson's jaw rippled as he tried to contain his anger. He finally barked, "Anything else? Perhaps she wants a key to the city?"
"No, sir. That's everything."